Hello and welcome to the Wine About History podcast. Today, I am your host, and today we are talking about Francis Sheeran. Here to join me is...
M-Bomb. You just said, I'm your host, but you didn't say your name, even though we all know it's...
We all know.
Mad Max, the mad ranter of history.
I suppose. Why don't you tell my social security number while you're at it?
We're drinking it's...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. It's Apothic Rose. We're drinking Apothic Rose. Please don't sue us because we like your wine.
Why would they sue us because we like their wine?
I don't know.
It's a rosé.
It's a rosé.
Okay, we kind of have a...
Okay.
All right, we have a long-standing joke.
There's a joke.
About rosé wine. And as a joke, we call it rose wine.
Yes.
So sometimes it slips out.
Yeah. So every time I make a mistake, take a drink. That's a new drinking game. Every time I stutter, say seems, apparently, you may not live.
Literally.
So today we're going over Frank the Irishman Sheeran, also known as Francis Sheeran, also known as Cheech. And he is the subject of an excellent book. I advise all of you to go out and get a copy because they're going to make a movie about it. I read this book in, 2012?
Yeah, you read it
a while ago. A long time ago. And I'm kind of had my hipster moment. I knew about it before they're making a movie about it.
Yeah, I love that.
Yes. Well, I've been studying organized crime for about 10 years. So I'm so surprised that book will come across my desk. What's important is that book was written by Francis Sheeran and Charles Brandt. We're going to give them their dues.
Yeah.
And under the 1976 Fair Use Act, we are protected. We are criticizing, commenting, or parroting the book. We're going to be talking about the book, commenting on it, as well as Francis Sheeran's life. Yes.
Okay.
I'm related to a lawyer. That explains the whole speech just now. So, Francis Sheeran was a big, big, literally a big bad mafia guy. He was 6'4". He was half Swedish, half Irish.
Oh.
And he would this is something, he was good friends with Jimmy Hoffa and the little known Russell Bufalino, who is, according to the McClellan Committee, a bunch of senators who investigated organized crime, that he was the most ruthless and dangerous mafia organized criminal in America at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, he's the guy that what's his name? The Godfather was based off of Corleone. Yeah,
seriously?
Yes.
Oh,
and he actually went down there to talk to Marlon Brando. And all the quiet little things he does, that's all Russell Bufalino.
Seriously?
Yes. But we're not talking... Yes, we're talking about Frank Sheeran, who was born in 1920. And one of his earliest memories is his Irish mother picking birdshot out of his butt. Because this is back when people were poor. Up into the 1890s, most people lived on a dollar a day in today's money. Not adjusted for inflation, in today's money. This is during the Depression, though.
I don't know how you do it.
You do a lot of stealing. This is what Frank's dad would do. Frank was the...
I think you'd have to.
Frank was the oldest, so he got a lot of crap. His dad would drive him out to farmers, and he would jump over the hedge to grab different food. And he would throw onions or corn to his dad to see, all right, this corn's bad, try the onions. But they didn't want to shoot the farmers would see this kid, they didn't want to shoot him, so they put birdshot in. Birdshot is a much smaller pellets of gunshot. I mean, shot for a shotgun. So it won't necessarily kill you, you have to be in about 20 yards and aiming for a vital area. So they'd shoot this little kid in the butt scrambling up there.
Aww.
Well, he's stealing from them. That's their livelihood. People steal from farmers all the time. His mother, May, asked his father, why am I always picking this stuff out of Francis's behind? Because the boy don't run fast enough.
Can I ask how old was he at this time?
I think he was single digits.
Oh, my
God. So 6, 8, 9. This is the Depression.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
He
was born in... No.
Depression
wasn't until the 30s, so he would have been at least 12, 13, 14.
Okay, yeah.
So he was in his teens.
The stock market crashed in 1929.
1929 or so. So he was in his teens. So I don't want anything single digits. I don't know.
Was it before the Depression that they were
still maybe spreading? He was very poor. Yeah, they were his poor. Dad was very poor. I could have gotten things mixed up. The things you learn about yourself. His dad was a kind of a troublemaker. This is also during Prohibition. His dad would make him take fistfight other kids for beers because his dad was so poor.
Wait, what?
Yes, he'd say go up to a bar and say, "I bet you a beer, or a speakeasy," and bet a guy, "I bet my son can beat your son."
His dad was using him.
That's what children were for back then. It's a different world.
Yeah.
His dad never said he loved him. His dad never hugged him.
Yeah, and look what the result was.
Well, he did that to all his children. The whole generation did that. So imagine that. If you're my generation, millennial, your grandparents never heard "I love you." Explains why they're so tough. And their parents never heard "I love you." And their parents probably heard "I hate you." So, different world.
Different world.
Different world. So, back on track. So here's an example of what Francis is. Francis was, I bet he had ADD. He's kind of a naughty kid. He would do things like bring Limburger cheese into the school and smear it on the radiator. Because it was so cold, the radiator would take a while to heat up. So they'd be go in school wrapped up, and all of a sudden they begin to smell this Limburger cheese on the radiator.
For people that don't know, Limburger's super stinky.
It's super stinky. His dad's the janitor.
Oh.
And this is another thing about his dad. They were so poor, they basically moved every 3 months to avoid eviction notices and debt. Oh. So every 3 months, his dad... His dad did this to him all the time. Threw him a pair of boxing gloves and said, "Do you want to get the crap beaten out of you before or after dinner?" He always would have it after dinner because he knew he wouldn't feel good after getting punched a lot.
Oh, so his dad would just beat him up?
Yeah, and they would fight. They would box.
Oh, okay.
But one day he threw the gloves back and said, "I'm not gonna be your punching bag anymore." And you know what Frank Sheeran did?
Hmm.
He joined the carnival.
Cool. He was a carny.
This guy's movie's like, this guy's life is like a movie. So
well,
he joins the carnival. So we're going to get into a little NSFW territory here. So he was a ticket counter and he would help guys pull things up, put up the tents and things like that. When two girls, they're basically strippers or go-go dancers who had these little, their nicknames are Little Neptune and, Blue Neptune and Little Egypt. And they would dance and pull off these veils for men. It was the adult show. They liked him and they let him sleep in their tent and then with him. And one night he would just go back and forth in between their beds every night.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
So the carny life wasn't so bad for him.
No, for him. His buddies were sleeping underneath a truck at the time. So no, not. Well, the carny folk didn't fold. They had to go down to Florida because it was winter.
Yeah.
So what he did?
Hmm.
He went up to, this is all in Pennsylvania, by the way. He's from Pennsylvania.
Okay.
He became a lumberjack.
Sure. That's tough work.
Yeah,
I think it paid pretty well, but it was.
No, not really.
Really? I thought like it paid well, but it was super dangerous.
It is super dangerous. And they were bored. All they did was drink, eat beef stew, and beat the crap out of each other.
Yeah, and people got squashed by trees all the time.
He didn't talk about that.
No.
I read the book, but he didn't talk about that. But I'll tell you what he did talk about. War.
Okay.
He became an MP in 1941. He was listening to Tuxedo Junction, which is a big song at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was their Gangnam Style.
Okay.
Up, Tuxedo Junction. it's a terrible joke. This is just a terrible joke. So we invade Italy during World War II, and he joins. Now, being an MP, it means you're military police. It means you're a guard. You arrest people. He goes to Sicily and he meets Digsy Myers, a Jewish kid from the same reason he is, and he said, well, I want to see some action. And then he hears, on the shores of Sicily. And he's like, what's that? It's your action. Here's a shovel. Keep digging. So the Germans gave the Italians artillery. And the kind of artillery that was just from hell. So they would dig in these foxholes. It would rain. The foxholes would freeze over. So they had to kick through the ice to be in their foxholes and freeze. And what they're like knee deep in ice cold water. That's why he got arthritis later.
Yeah.
He was in the whole war from Sicily to the surrender. And he saw 411 days of combat. The average amount is 100.
Wow.
For a World War II veteran. Wow. He was part of the 44th or 41st Killer Division. It's because Patton told them, what's happening is German soldiers are murdering people, mm-hmm. then surrendering,
mm-hmm.
killing the people they surrendered to, and then murdering more soldiers. They were committing all these war crimes. He said, we're not going to let them do that. Take no prisoners. Kill them all. So, war crimes, hello. But he talked about Sicily. He talked about how bad it was. Like, they didn't judge people for going AWOL or going crazy. If you were there for combat to rep your guys, that was fine. But if you ran off, he spent, what did he say? He spent 50 days lost under AWOL, absent without leave, mostly spent drinking wine and chasing Italian girls in Sicily. So that's, yeah, a crazy guy. Yeah, there's one story. They're running up a hill in Sicily. He looks down. He's just covered in red. He goes, I'm hit. I'm hit. And his officer says, you idiot, Sharon. Get up. Get up. You need a medic. That's wine, not blood. It had hit his canteen.
Oh.
He was drunk the entire time because it was so bad. Yeah, a bunch of things happened. Like, I could tell you a dozen stories about his combat years. His combat years, yeah. They're just nasty. Like, he literally made people, they found a supply squad in the Harz Mountains of Germany. So they made them dig their own graves with their helmets.
Ooh.
Like in the movies, again. And he said, I'll never understand why they did it. They could have thrown the helmet at one of us and run off into the woods or something to distract, you know, thrown it to distract us and then run off. They just kept hoping that we'd spare their lives.
Yeah, that's it exactly.
And no, we did not.
Wow.
What happened was your commanding officer would say, take these Germans to the end of the line, to our lines, hurry back. And hurry back was code for kill all of them. Leave their bodies. Get back here.
Wow. Well, I didn't think we were that mean.
You have to be. Well, we wiped out entire cities. People understand how evil war is.
Yeah, it's
just evil. Speaking of which, he was at Dachau.
Mm-hmm.
He found Dachau.
Oh,
wow. Yeah.
Oh, really? He was one of the people, like, rescued them?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And he remembers, he said he didn't want to talk about it, but he did remember giving one of his guns to a Jew who's strong enough to hold it and helping him shoot down the captured officers of Dachau.
Wow.
I could be wrong. I could be confused in that story. Maybe he did it, or maybe someone else did it. But
when they rescued people from Dachau, the German officers started dressing like the prisoners
mm-hmm.
that were there, hoping that they wouldn't be noticed, even though they weighed, like,
doubled. Tall, blue eyes, blonde hair, dead giveaway.
And weighed double. They weren't
starving to death.
Initiated. And all the prisoners were like, that guy's a guard. And gave him away. They didn't do too well. Anyway, we got a little off track there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he was also at the Battle of the Bulge. He was everywhere. I mean, like, get this guy's book. Seriously. Get the book. Read it. It's amazing, some of the stories. I don't want to tell too much of the story because I want to ruin the book for people.
Right.
But, so, he's in these war crimes. He sees Dachau. And then on the way back, he runs into his brother. He's going slowly going back to America. It took a while to get their troops home. And his brother looks at him and goes, you've changed. First thing he says, you've changed, Frank. And he said what it was like was people, you had to cover yourself in lead, kind of a lead casing, and not connect to people mentally. Mentally cover yourself in a lead casing and your heart in steel, because you meet someone new and you'd be like, yeah, I'm going to be your buddy and we're going to be warriors again. It's like, you're going to be dead before your boots dry off. And people would literally die with their boots still wet because they didn't make it 20 feet from the beach, the shore. So that obviously affected his mental state and who he was as a person. His first job, he got a job back. I remember this story. His job was to mix blueberry or something to do with a blueberry. Oh, he's shoveling blueberries into a pie machine to make blueberry pies and a pie filling. And his foreman's, you're a little lazy on that shovel. And he says, I don't care. His foreman's giving him crap. Foreman's giving him crap. And the guy was a big guy. But he didn't know this guy had just seen 411 days of combat. Turned around, punched him in the face, punched him, right hook here in the jaw. If you feel your jaw line and work your way up. Frank talks about this. At the top of your jaw, if you hit someone just right with a right hook there, they go down. He threw him on the conveyor belt and started shoving blueberries in his mouth. Jeez. Yeah. You think you know assholes. Frank was just, well, he just killed probably hundreds of people.
Yeah.
He's losing it.
When I tell somebody at work they're not working hard enough, they just complain about me behind my back.
But pardon me?
Any day.
Pardon me?
So when I complain about somebody at work, they just, or no, when I tell somebody at work they're not working hard enough or meeting their goals, they just complain behind my back, which is better than being hit in the jaw and having blueberries shoved in your mouth.
Yeah.
Right?
So he became a trucker after that. He learned to ride a big rig, and he worked for Food Fair. And because, again, everyone's so poor back then, he started doing crimes on the side to make money. Like, there's, like, Food Fair, they would put an aluminum seal on your truck because it would be inspected by the foreman. But on cold days, it's cold outside, the foreman's going to hand you the seal. So he would sell the meat racks illegally and then drive up to the butcher office, because these are all meat packing stuff, and put his stuff on the receiving end hooks, go into the store's stock. So let's say it's half a cow. He'll put those cows on there, take the store's stock off, and add how many he sold on the way there.
Jeez.
So they'll notice an inventory and shortage, but they're just going to glance and go, oh, okay. One time, he sold the entire stock. He sold all the ham.
Their own stuff back.
No. He was in the Food Fair truck. He sold everything in the truck. And he said, oh, I thought it was a little light.
Funny.
Anyways, he got caught. So his friends got caught doing that. He said, I'm not going to turn on him. I'm not going to rat. And they said, okay, well, we won't prosecute him if you leave, because we know you're the one that's up to stuff. We just can't prove it. He actually broke into their office and stole the medical records. Or stole not the records, the evidence they had. He stole the evidence they had against him. Well, at this time, he's doing stuff like, the people he's selling the meat to are all gangsters, like Joey Greel, who he would sell these football lottery tickets. And that's around the time he meets Russell Bufalino, who we've touched on. And he's hanging around downtown Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And for those of you who know, Angelo Bruno was the boss of Philadelphia at the time. And his captain, Skinny Razor, I don't know his real name because everyone just knows his nickname. He's a real skinny guy who would kill chickens with a razor and sell them. Like, he had a chicken store. An Italian woman would come in and say, so I want that chicken. Okay, here you go. That's how you laundered money. He was working with these guys, doing this for them, doing that for them. And one guy said, somebody won't leave our friend's mistress alone. He wants to sleep with her, whatever. Here's a .32 caliber pistol. Go up there, show it to him, tell him to find his own girlfriend. And he did just that. And he said, nowadays they just shoot you. He was all angry. He was like romancing about, at the time he's going to the gym every day for 4 hours exercising. If there's pictures of him, his arms look like thighs. He's a huge guy. On top of being 6'4". He's half Swedish, half Irish. So just a big mean guy. And then he's talking to Busso Buffalino. And he's doing this for them, doing that for them, scaring people. And then this guy named Whispers comes along. His name is Whispers because he has halitosis so bad that he can only whisper to people without grossing them out. And he says, I need you to get rid of Cadillac Laundry Company. I'll give you $2,000 now, $8,000 later. Don't tell anyone. It's just you and me. Just you and me, our secret, little secret. Because Whispers has his own laundry company that he wants to flourish, but Cadillac's in the way because they're better. So he looks around at Cadillac. He's okay, I'll firebomb it. Cuts back, gets back home, and Russell Buffalino, who's very close to, and Andrew Bluno are waiting for him in the back of a restaurant called Vesuvio, which is like, again, something out of a movie. Like, they actually named this place Vesuvio. Skinny Razor locks the door. This time he's a loan shark. He's loan sharking for them. And they say, you have a problem. What are you doing around Cadillac? You know who has a piece of Cadillac? I do. Oh, you know? No. This is Andrew Bluno, the boss of Philadelphia, talking. I know who has, I have a piece of Cadillac. It's owned by the Jewish mafia, but they pay us off. Did Whispers put you up to this? Yeah. I bet he told you he'll give you two now and oh so many later. Yeah. Bet he told you not to tell anyone about this. Yeah. Yeah. He was going to kill you or let us kill you. And he was just going to pocket the $8,000.
Whoa.
So they said, you got a problem. You need to take care of this. We're not going to take care of it for you. Well, he thanks Russell and Angelo. Who he's so close right now, he felt embarrassed. He couldn't say Mr. Bruno, Mr. Ruffalino. He just said their first names because he's gotten so close to them. He's pushing a lot of money for them on the streets. So lo and behold, someone shoots Whisper with a .32 caliber. Yeah, statute of limitations. He didn't say who. He thinks he knows who. But then again, all of a sudden he loses that .32 caliber gun of his. What a weird coincidence. So then we meet Jimmy Hoffa. They call him over, and Skinny Razor's talking on the phone. Oh, good. It's nice to see you. Good. Okay. Hands the phone. First thing, Jimmy Hoffa says to Frank Sheeran, I hear you paint houses. And that means I hear you kill people.
Uh-huh.
Because paint is blood hitting a house.
Oh, okay.
So they call the slang word for blood was paint back then.
Oh, okay.
So,
I get it.
And that began the beginning of their relationship. That's how Frank Sheeran became Jimmy Hoffa's personal assassin. Thank you, and we'll see you for part two in the next episode. Due to the length of this podcast, this will be part one of a two-parter. If you have interest in Frank Sheeran, please join us in the next episode.